You are listening to The Andrew Miller Show. This episode was recorded when the show had a different name. Same show otherwise. Anyway, enjoy. Greetings, wonderful people. I'm Andrew Miller. Moving forward, you're listening to Get Yours Today. Get better candidates, get better government, get better results. Though smaller government may be the way to get such results, according to this episode's guest. With us is Greg Mealy, who is the Libertarian Party's candidate for governor of New Jersey. Greg is a lifelong resident of New Jersey, who's visited all 21 counties this year campaigning. Highly educated, as you can see on his website, mealyforgovernor.com, Mealy is spelled M-E-L-E. From civil liberties to taxation to COVID-related mandates and lockdowns, Greg Mealy has a lot to say and a lot to fight for and against. Let's hear it. Hello, Greg. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks very much, sir. Glad to be here.
All right, definitely. So I understand you're running for governor of New Jersey under the Libertarian Party. I noticed you did receive an endorsement from the conservative Republicans of Jackson Township. Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, is that more like fiscally conservative? Because I know socially conservative Republicans tend to be like anti-libertarian when it comes to a lot of personal freedom things.
Yeah, certainly we have positions that kind of go all across the board of conservative versus liberal, depending on the issue. But what we've seen is that for many Republicans, at least, the most important issues that they want to see a conservative response happen to align with our positions on those issues. And there was just this feeling that Mr. Cittarelli is just not conservative enough for them. I mean, he's sort of alienated a big group of his party by trying to pander, I guess, to the majority in the state that might be more liberal minded overall. And so when he was nominated, also when he picked his lieutenant governor candidate, we had floods of calls coming in to support us instead. And that's the genesis of that endorsement as a formal matter, which was kind of a breakthrough for us. I mean, it is hard to get the major party groups of any kind to make an official statement like that. So we're very proud of having accomplished that. And we also have a lot of people within both parties that have been talking about supporting us this time around. It seems like we sometimes lightly refer to them as the king and his clone. The other two parties, that you're really getting the same thing, whichever one you pick, and it's not good. I mean, we know the dictatorial aspects of our current governor. And for the other side, we're talking about a career politician. Now, that's been a dirty word for a long time, and it still should be, and for good reason. And so, I mean, you have decades without much to show for there. It's not an attractive alternative. So for the folks who are disappointed with their own party's nominee, they're still saying, well, but I could never vote for the other side. Where they're finding us to be a comfortable middle ground. And we have a lot of common sense solutions, I believe, that that appeal to a lot of people.
Well, there you go. And yeah, as far as Jack Cittarelli, I mean, while all the attack ads I see against him try to make him sound like most modern day Republicans throughout the rest of the country, I remember the last time he ran in the primary, 2017, for the nomination. I remember watching that debate, and he didn't win the nomination, but I remember thinking, yeah, if this guy did win the nomination, he does come off as a kind of guy who could win over a lot of so-called moderates and non-progressive Democrats. And I think maybe the Republicans would have had a slightly better chance instead of electing a Chris Christie's sidekick after how unpopular Chris Christie was.
Well, certainly Chris Christie's antics, I guess, later on with Bridgegate really made it difficult for any Republican to win last time, in my view. But yeah, and the thing is, even with the Democrats outpacing Republicans for registrations for voters. I mean, people still want to be represented. And that's the thing. I mean, there's still a core group of conservatives that feel totally homeless now. And I think the problem for Jack is that in order to speak to the moderate and liberal leaning people, he's really got to sacrifice the conservatives. And the problem otherwise is that, especially now, I mean, Murphy talks about him being a Trump supporter, even though he's far from it, I think. It's also keeping some of the other liberal voters away from Jack as an alternative. So he's really, it seems to me he's not going to be able to make up in additional more left-leaning voters what he's losing on the right. So, and the fact that he goes kind of a little bit back and forth, he has been sending messages directly to people at events that I've actually attended, protests and things like that. He has sent emissaries to them with messages that appeal to conservatives, but then he gets on the public airwaves and he says the opposite. And you know, people pick up on that. And you know, when you don't, you know, when you change with the wind, you know, whatever you know audience you have in front of you, I mean, it's going to catch up with you. And that's one thing I love about this party of mine is that you know our message is consistent and we don't vary from it. We know what we want to accomplish. And the theme being consistent across different issues is what really makes it easy to speak to any audience and make them you know see at least you know, we have positions, some things they agree with, some things they might not, but even the stuff that they don't, we have an explanation why it really makes sense. And in a practical, imperfect world that we're in, you know, they really do address a lot of the issues that are causing the problems in this state and in this country.
Wow. And were you originally a Republican at first? And whether or not you were, what made you decide to go with the Libertarian Party? Like what really did it for you?
Yeah, so I mean, I was lifelong Republican from pretty much birth. I mean, I grew up in a blue collar working class town. And I was there till about 10 years ago. And the main reason that it, you know the party appealed to me was the idea of fiscal restraint and small government, all this stuff. They got away from it. I mean, starting with Bush Jr. on that side of the aisle, I mean, they really got away from being responsible with taxpayer money. And so in that respect, they joined the Democrats and totally alienated people like me. I feel that liberty and freedom are too important to sacrifice where now we have government with their hands in every aspect of our lives. It's really sad. So I got fed up for a while there, and I actually didn't pay much attention to politics for a few years after that. But then I felt the urge that, you know, I really had to take a stand and make an effort to improve things. And initially I did a small, like, you know, test the waters kind of independent run a few years ago. And just to find out kind of what it was like, that kind of thing. You see the name on the ballot the first time, that kind of thing. No fundraising, no special things going on. And I caught the attention of some of the people in the Libertarian Party. I decided to go, to meetings with them and find out what they were all about, of course, and found out that there was a lot of alignment there on all issues. And in that respect, you know, I felt more and more that the other two parties really have extreme positions many areas. And for us, it's really the practical approach. And that's always been attractive to me in my work in education. I mean, besides achieving several degrees, I also taught for many years in grad school, about 9 years worth. And what attracted me to that program as a professor was basically the idea that they were offering practical solutions to those courses. I wound up writing half a dozen courses and teaching them during that time period that was for Stevens. It was always the way I thought to approach things. It's, you know, how can we actually in this world, in a realistic way, make things work better? And I've carried that through now into my platform in my attempts this year.
All right. And yeah, I understand the party is a lot about, you know, get the government out of a lot of things. And when it comes to the civil liberties, you know, there's people all over the political spectrum who are down with that, especially nowadays, more people are waking up and realizing Yeah, you know, what are we doing? You know, yeah, a person with a bag of grass in their pocket shouldn't do more jail time than people who commit rape, for example. You know, so, you know, just like you've seen with the ballot questions last election. So, you know, more people are like waking up to the whole civil liberty thing. Like, yeah, I mean, government really shouldn't be making criminals out of people who really aren't. But then when it comes to the fiscal matters, though, I mean, especially New Jersey, everybody, you know, has had it with taxes, especially property taxes. And of course, you know, if someone who thinks, hey, you know, has a more progressive platform and lists all these things that we should have a government program for, you know, everyone will like at least one or two things from it. But some people may say, you know, that's kind of a tall order, you know, so they may think, you know, maybe that's too much to comprehend. That's too extreme. How are we going to pay for it? But then when there's get the government out of everything and privatize everything, you know, there's always going to be people, no matter how anti-minimum wage they are, no matter how anti-welfare they are, no matter how anti-taxes they are, they still want public schools to be good, especially where they live, you know, if they can't afford a private school to send their kids to, or, you know, if they commute in and out of New York City, they still want the trains to run frequently and on time and be reliable. So do you ever think that sometimes, you know, you may be stepping on some people's toes regarding that? And if so, how do you address that with people who know, you know, they don't want the government out of everything, or something needs to be publicly financed?
Right. Yeah. I mean, certainly. Yeah. I mean, I don't advocate for 100% removal of taxes overnight or anything like that. I mean, the thing is, right now we have a lot of waste in what's being spent with the tax funding. In the school system, I mean, one reason that, I mean, while New Jersey, domestically in the United States, has remained relatively highly ranked for the public school system, internationally, we've gone from first to 26th over the last several decades, ever since the Board of Ed, federal and state, were established. And the reason is, I mean, when I was, you know, younger adult, getting out to vote the first bunch of times, I mean, everything was about, you know, the school budget being part of the ballot. And we would all say, well, of course, it's a sacred cow. It's our children. We have to vote yes and give whatever money we can to the children so they have a good education. The problem is the money never got to the classroom. And the teachers have had some improvements in their salaries, but they're still getting their own supplies and things like that. And education has been centralized to say, no matter where you are, you should have a cookie cutter curriculum and all this other stuff. And with the administrations themselves, I mean, we have so many different districts and so many layers within each district, all making high, you know, well, I should say, low to medium six figures. For those positions, it's just not justifiable, and it's such a waste. And some of them are no-show jobs. I mean, it's just so much problems there that that's a big chunk of what we're looking to attack in terms of reducing that. I mean, quite frankly, as far as school districts, that for the administrative side, I mean, 21 of them would be plenty. One per county, that's it. And meanwhile, we have so much fat there. It's just not sustainable, and that's why we have the situation we have. Also, the pension system has to be reformed over time. I mean, people toward the end of their career, you know, they've counted on it and they should receive it. I mean, it's not fair to pull it out from under the rug out from under them so late in the game career-wise. But younger teachers, you know, things like that. I mean, anyone that's got these public pensions coming their way, there should be a phase-in approach where it eventually is totally privatized, 401k style, for example, to really use the efficient market of the private sector. I mean, just about anything, the private sector outperforms the government every time. So that's an area where we want to convert that over a period of time to make it more efficient, leaner, more profitable for those saving for retirement, and get the government bureaucracy out of it. The third area we talk about in terms of trying to reform and improve, you know, the costs to cut taxes is Medicaid system, where right now there's no negotiating prices for medication. There's problems with lack of adequate treatment in some cases. This is the sort of free market competition pitch that I propose in terms of making that a more wide open market where there's lower barriers to entry for competition, and then the bidding of the prices will bring those down while quality will go up. On the other side of it, by the way, in terms of the school system, it's school choice. That's the competition that's needed to improve things again and get us back to number one globally. That's where the funding follows the student, so that if a school is not performing, they will have to fold. I mean, it has to be that kind of situation, like it is in almost every other area of life, certainly the private sector. If you don't perform and do it cost effectively, you're out. And that's what it has to be in order to make people really, get off the stick and just go forward with a better product. And in that case, education, with Medicaid, better healthcare.
All right. And yeah, and you mentioned the private sector outperforming government and free market solutions and such, which brings me to this topic, climate change. You acknowledge that it exists, and that's good, because the political debate on climate change shouldn't be whether it's, as Donald Trump called it, a Chinese hoax, or if it's something that's real. No, it is real. Whether we like it or not. The real debate should be like, all right, well, how do we approach that? I mean, does it call for more government regulation, or does it call for more like incentivizing instead? Or should we acknowledge what cannot be undone and just prioritize how to react, how to prepare for the results of that are coming? And I know you mentioned working with the private sector to develop innovative solutions to climate change. So like, what kind of solutions would those be?
Yeah. So first, just let me say, as far as acknowledging climate change, I mean, certainly ever since mankind has been industrializing, certainly, the temperatures are up, which causes some of the weather effects that we see. It's a natural outflow of that activity. Can we go back to, pre-industrialization? Of course not. There's no way to do that. So how do we control the climate change to at least be something manageable where it doesn't destroy many lives in various ways with the weather and otherwise? So as far as the private sector involvement, and certainly, yes, encouraging innovation, if there's research, there should be some kind of tax relief to be able to afford real thorough private sector research. As far as the energy platforms, I mean, there are a lot of misconceptions about a lot of the different sort of clean energy solutions being talked about. Electrical, there's as much of carbon footprint as oil, just about. And the recycling issues, or lack of ability to recycle, is the problem with some of the wind proposals. The proposal for the cleanest renewable energy source for our party for a long time, and what I happen to also agree with, is the nuclear power. France has, I think it's around 90% of their power is nuclear. And over time, I mean, you have to remember, we haven't built any new nuclear plants in the US in decades, but in France, they use it almost exclusively, and it's much safer with the technology that's available now in terms of building those plants. As far as Japan, Fukushima, I believe, was the one that had a meltdown. But even with the problems they had, I mean, years past, that would have been much more devastating and catastrophic for a much, much wider area. And to a pretty fair extent, they were able to contain that situation from getting completely out of control. And that's where we need to move in terms of safer energy for the nuclear, and then the footprint is far less than anything else. So we need to encourage that kind of innovation, for example, to say, the companies need to be left to figure out how they can, have appropriate safety and still have this this energy source available. It would cure a lot of things if it's done right.
All right. And as far as the role of governor itself, there are instances where things just come our way, things that were not exactly predicted or thought about when campaigning, or running on a platform or deciding which party to run as. And we've seen it the past few years with Governor Murphy. You know, there is that the first snowstorm that happened on his watch was, you know, that was a disaster. And, you know, we've done so much better through so much worse. I mean, now he learned from that, you know, so I'll give him that. But at the same time, yeah, it still doesn't reflect well on him. You know, like, I'm glad I wore my hiking boots to work that day instead of my usual dress shoes to work. And I feel because I had to hike from Newark Broad Street Station all the way to where I live in North Arlington.
Okay. Wow.
New Jersey. So, yeah, had I worn my dress shoes, which I normally would wear to work, it would have been a very bad situation for me. So,
And then
the COVID-19 pandemic came. And, you know, so when it comes to handling things on that come, and especially with the COVID-19, his handling of it, you know, is there anything he fell short of, anything you would do differently or not do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly in the beginning, no one knew what we were dealing with COVID. So, you know, to some degree, I mean, I'm not a fan of emergency powers. It's very rare that I believe it's justified, actually, in terms of mandating things. And that's the thing. I mean, we have, for example, now we have mask wearing or not, we have vaccination or not, we have remote learning or not, actually, too. These are all options that should be available for everybody. And so as far as the government's role, it's supposed to be a situation where they provide, you know, good research and inform and even make recommendations, but there shouldn't be the mandate. I mean, you know, when hurricane warnings come, you know, people are advised to leave, but some do stay. And it's the nature of humanity too, that we have to make our own decisions as grownups and have the personal responsibility to handle the consequences of those decisions. Now, that does translate to a lot of things that pretty much everybody does, but because it makes sense, not because the government tells you that you shouldn't question whether it makes sense or not, you just have to do it. So in the case of COVID, I mean, up until recently, we were number one for per capita death rate in the country, and actually against any country in the world also. We just recently slipped to number two behind Mississippi. But you know, in that respect, I think the problem that we've had with masks is that many kinds of masks, especially homemade stuff that people make, I mean, it makes them feel safe. But unfortunately, the material is too wide between the threads that the virus gets in there. And so they wear a mask like that, thinking they're protected. They go out boldly and go in with crowds, and then they catch it because it's really not protecting them, those kinds of masks. I mean, the N95 is the best one, and that's not foolproof either. But all the other stuff is really, you know, dramatics. So that, unfortunately, you know, and it's interesting that there's anyone who thinks that our governor has done a fantastic job with COVID. I mean, you know, his ideas have done very little to help the actual virus situation while decimating small business, the economy, jobs, you know, being lost, all this kind of stuff. The other thing I want to point out, just because you started this conversation with the snowstorm before, I mean, we had Ida recently, and of course, all the flooding that resulted from that and all the problems that happened from that. Now, in that respect, it's interesting that now we have some rain overnight just now, and early evening last night before there was a drop, all of a sudden we had the emergency declaration statewide. You know, no exceptions, right? Well, of course, that was a reaction to the accusation that Ida was handled, you know, too casually by our governor in terms of emergency declaration and what have you. Well, the problem is it's deeper than that. I mean, yes, you know, if he warned people earlier and declared an emergency earlier, yeah, you might have saved some of the lives that were lost that day. I mean, there are people who are going to, you know, do certain things and they put themselves in jeopardy, but I do feel like we certainly could have had an improved, at least, number of fatalities from Ida. But the other part of Ida that was a problem is, after previous storms, especially in places, for example, I mean, I'm right near Manville, South Bound Brook, they have recurring flooding all the time. There's a couple of other hot spots throughout the state where it always seems to happen. And The problem for that is, you know, over time from previous flooding, we had levees built and all these locks to be able to prevent the water rising too high in these low-lying areas, and they failed. So in that respect, it's interesting that Mr. Cittarelli accuses Governor Murphy of the late notice, which, I mean, yeah, there, I believe there is some truth to that being a flaw of the governor in not calling the emergency earlier in that situation. I mean, there was plenty of warning that it would be a big one, but Mr. Cittarelli has just as much responsibility for being in government for so many years and not making sure that the work on those levees and locks and any other stuff to prevent another major disaster flood in, you know, residential areas and such, you know, wasn't done properly. I mean, the work was not done well because the bidding system for public contract work is not competitive enough and there are not enough standards in it. And that's why we pay, I mean, just as an example for the roads, the repair cost per mile in New Jersey is astronomically higher than any other state in the country. And why is that? Because there are sweetheart deals made and there's prevailing wage, which is an artificial wage that, you know, in my economic side of my background, I mean, there's no way to outperform the free market. You know, government gets into it, it skews something. And just like we saw now with minimum wage, you can't change that in isolation. It affected inflation and it was totally predictable for folks who are familiar with economics. But for the prevailing wage, that's where if you have a government contract, if you win a bid on a government contract for particularly infrastructure, you have to pay what is called the prevailing wage to the workers out there on the roadways, which is somewhat of an artificially high inflated rate of hourly pay. So you're spending way more, but you're also having limited people who can compete at that level of paying people. I mean, a lot of smaller construction companies can't compete having to pay those kinds of salaries. So you have a limited number of bidders. And so you have all kinds of opportunity for people to cut corners. And we saw that happen with some of these things that failed during the storm. So Mr. Cittarelli has also been, like I said, involved in government for so long that he had every opportunity to address that. And I mean, we never saw anything from him, as well as, I mean, with Governor Murphy, to try to figure out, you know, how do we make this a better, more competitive system to make sure we have high quality and efficient low cost.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because Jack has been in New Jersey's government for a pretty long time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's supposed to be a dirty word the last few years called career politician. I mean, that was brought to light in the last several years, that the people who are really the problem in Congress are all the people who are there 20, 30, 40 years. Now, they're the ones who are so entrenched that for them, like, they're never returning to the private sector, which is never what government is supposed to be. You were supposed to do your civic service, and then you're supposed to go back to the private sector and be subject to the laws you create. And that would keep the people in government, you know, more honest about trying to find good solutions that are helpful to the people, because eventually they would be among the people again. But we have all these long timers in government, and their sole mission is to get reelected. So they will do whatever they need to do to make sure they keep having funding coming in and that they keep just running on advertising for their campaigns instead of doing the work of the people. And that's why we have so many people in Congress we talk about all the time, as far as, you know, they really need to go. It's because their ideas are not even stale. It's just that they don't have any ideas because they're not interested. All they care about is working in government till they die. And with Mr. Cittarelli, I mean, we're talking about the same thing. We're talking about a career politician. I mean, you know, he had some private sector experience before, but he's not going to have to work again in the private sector. So he really didn't accomplish very much in all the years he had a chance to in state government. And so I look at both of them as really, you know, idea challenged for, you know, really making New Jersey a better place.
Wow. And as far as tax and spend issues and such, I remember in 2017, the Libertarian Party candidate then, Peter Roorman, he had something in his platform that, you know, I don't always see in the platform, well, of anyone running for office, but even the Libertarian Party itself? I mean, there's some in the party who are on board with this type of thing, others perhaps not so much. In his platform, he called it fiscal democracy. I know other places it's called participatory budgeting, but what he mentioned there is average New Jersey family is forced to pay approximately 30% of their income to the state, county, and municipal governments. My fiscal democracy plan will limit this to 10% and allow you, the individual, to choose which government programs your tax payments will fund. And this moves the power of appropriations out of the irresponsible legislators' hands and places that power directly into yours. Mm-hmm. Now, is that the kind of idea that you would be on board with? Is that something you agree with? Or do you think things are more complex than that?
And I think we are in alignment with that as part of our platform. I mean, really part of the idea of reducing taxes as much as we'd like to is basically to keep it to really core needs. I mean, on the one side of it, as far as, you know, to the extent there are going to be taxes, we prefer enablement programs, such as, for example, instead of handing out for unemployment, you know, have that tax money go to training and retraining programs to enable people to become self-sufficient so that it is temporary. I mean, unemployment compensation, you know, welfare, all these kinds of things. I mean, they're not meant for at least the large majority to be career income sources. I mean, we understand there are hardship cases where people will not be able to go out and support themselves again. And disability, of course, there's a good sized number of folks in that group, but there are people who are gaming the system, and it's too easy to get a fish every day. The problem is you're not learning how to fish. And that's the old, you know, theme as far as what we really need to do to make people better off. The trouble is big government doesn't want people to be self-sufficient. So they do everything they can not to help people become self-sufficient and support their own families. That's always been the problem with that. Now, as far as Mr. Roerman's platform plank in particular on that, the way that that fits into what I've just been talking about is that we are big on also volunteerism and charity and things like that. I think on the one hand, when it's a government benefit, it's a lot easier for someone to take the handout every day when they don't have to look in the eyes of the giver and when it's the government and as an entity. But in the charitable situation, I mean, people tend to not want to overdo any kind of requests for charitable money. And when they have to look in the eye of the person handing over the payment, you know, they feel more responsible. They feel, you know, I want to do whatever I can to improve my situation so I can give back, that kind of thing. And when it's a monolithic sort of, you know, detached government entity, there's not that same feeling of obligation. And the problem is people have to have pride, and they have to have work ethic, and they have to have productivity be part of their work life to feel satisfaction. And all the studies talk about the benefits of work, right? So we need people to be in that kind of mode where, yes, they're looking to get right back, you know, on their feet or whatever it is, or improve to the next, you know, rung up in terms of quality of life, standard of living for themselves and their family. And in that respect, the government programs should be as streamlined and as minimal as possible for that. I mean, we don't want to leave anyone, you know, dropping off a cliff because we pull the rug out from under them. But we want people to understand that there needs to be participation by them also in terms of, like I said, retraining, for example, for unemployment benefits.
Yeah.
There has to be an end goal that isn't that they stay where they are unemployed and receiving the benefit forever. It's no good for them as well as anyone else. And everyone has the ability to get back to work, improve their situation, get a better job if they work hard enough. I mean, I never had any breaks come to me. I had, like I said, a few degrees in my background, and I did a lot of training there and a lot of work experience. And still, I mean, I'm just a regular guy that happens to be a solo practitioner in law. So I worked very hard to get even just that. And it's not the living that it used to be as far as the old boys club, I can assure you. So, you know, I'm not worried about making a fortune. I've never done anything with work or in this political thing for that matter. based on, you know, wanting to improve my own lot. I mean, my thing is, in my practice every day, I see that I help several people, and the satisfaction I get from that, and what I would have if I could help everyone in the state of New Jersey by being elected, that means more to me than anything else.
Yeah. You mentioned about unemployment and job retraining, and I know they do have programs within it. But I remember, like, this is years ago, so I don't know what's changed since then, but it was right here in New Jersey, like, I'd say late 2000s. And yeah, I was, well, like a lot of people at that time, yes, you know, I was unemployed for a little bit. I mean, I've never been like on unemployment for like a year or anything like that. Like usually like maybe a couple months is the longest I'd ever be on it. But yeah, I did look in the whole like job retraining thing or certification thing, thinking, yeah, maybe I could improve my situation here and make myself more marketable. And oh yeah, there's like this grant, you know, that you could get. But there was like all this like bureaucracy and red tape involved in it and a lot of waiting games where, like, in order to hopefully get it, you know, you had to be collecting unemployment longer up until that point, because if you get a job and get off unemployment, you know, you're out of the running for it. And, you know, I'm personally not against the idea of things like unemployment and all that. I figure, you know, you're paying taxes, whether you like it or not anyway, you know, get something out of it. But yeah, I mean, in order to retraining thing though, I mean, that it shouldn't be that complex and that bureaucratic. It should be like, oh, you want it, pal, right here. Oh, and if you find another job, so what? You should still be able to get that grant and get that certification and such, because it doesn't take much to get it. And this was before, you know, long before COVID, with that, you know, extra 300, extra 600 everywhere. Yeah, you know, getting an unemployment check, I mean, it was like, okay, I could eat for a couple of days, but it wasn't anything like, oh, wow, I mean, why go to work when I could do this? It was still like, no, I really need to get a job as soon as I can here. Yeah. And it doesn't take a high paying job to disqualify you from continuing to get an unemployment check either.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and like I said, I mean, we're not looking to eliminate benefits like that, especially for unemployment, for Social Security. I mean, people have paid into it. So it is really fair that they can get something back out of it from what they paid when the need arises. The difficulty is the people who, again, you know, they don't have a plan for the future to change things for their betterment. So, there have been programs for some training in a limited way in unemployment. But the other problem is now, especially, to get benefits, and you don't have to show for work, especially in those higher, which now has finally been coming down back to the previous sort of numbers you could qualify for. But that was just unfathomable to me. I mean, how do you tell someone, okay, you're going to get maybe as much or more even than when you were working, to just stay home and you don't have to get out and look for anything or anything like that? I mean, the problem is people don't understand sometimes, and they're going to lose their skills, whatever they had, if they don't keep them current for a long enough period of time. And when that money runs out, and it will always run out, they're not going to have that benefit anymore. And then they're going to be wondering, oh, what am I going to do now? I forgot how to do what I used to do. I can't even get a job in my old career. And now suddenly they've really had the rug pulled out from under them in that respect, because they're not ready to re-enter the workforce. So it's really, I mean, especially in these last couple of years, it's been so backwards. We really need to set up a program that emphasizes that there are options for you, and you can look into whatever fields you want, and you'll be able to bridge the gap with some temporary benefit like that, but it's not a career position. And you know, that's the thing that really has to be stressed for people, because eventually, like I said, I mean, the money always will run out. I mean, Venezuela is all I should need to say about that. So if you don't want to go down that path, then you have to keep people productive and keep them skilled. And I mean, I'll say, especially New Jersey, but even across the country, we have a highly skilled workforce in this country, and especially in the state. So we need to leverage that to say, hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with working, you know, for a living and having those benefits of work, as well as getting paid for that. And then you have the buying power to support other people working. And it's that economic effect where it multiplies the money supply without printing money that has the inflationary effect we're seeing lately.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because with unemployment, I mean, that's always set to expire too. So, I mean, luckily I've been blessed during the pandemic. You know, I haven't lost my job, and, you know, my company, I have to say, handled it real well with all of a sudden have everybody working remotely. And that went really smoothly compared to what I've seen other people go through. So I feel blessed in that regard. Mm-hmm. And as far as, you know, people being out of work, you know, I never had anything against people collecting unemployment. I've had nothing against people getting that extra that was put into it because, hey, it helps them keep a roof over their head. That's great. And if people have been paying into it their entire working life and will be again when they work again, you know, yeah, I'm in no position to judge anybody about that. Like, you know, if they're not looking for a while, but the only thing, you know, like if I was in that situation, I would realize that because it's going to expire, that's when it's going to become more competitive to get a job when that happens than before that happens. You know, so that's something worth noting. So if somebody during that time took a job that paid only a little bit less than what they were getting, I wouldn't call them a sucker either.
No, I mean, and yeah, some people handled it the right way that way, just like you're describing. Some people figured that they're gonna, you know, play the game as far as they can take it and not plan for the future. And I mean, look, you know, I'm not looking to tell people how to manage their lives either. I mean, you know, if you want people who want to, you know, run every decision of your life, you know, look at the other two guys. But, you know, for me, it's really having options and enabling people. Like I said, they, you know, people should become self-sufficient. And yeah, I mean, I am more than happy with the idea, especially because they've paid into it in the case of unemployment compensation. But even without that, I mean, some level of support for sort of shorter term gaps, I'll call it. I mean, if you're not able to get work for a while, you still should be trying for that, I think. And, you know, I think that, you know, that makes things better off. And also then you can understand if you have had a benefit, how helpful it is to bridge the gap, you know, and for example, keep paying your mortgage through a period of unemployment, or your rent or whatever. You know, that's very important to have. And so, yeah, I wouldn't eliminate stuff like that. I mean, especially, like I said, I mean, you're paying into it. It's your money. So, yeah, it should be there for those emergencies. But it should be emergency situations that don't last forever by definition. That's why, you know, Governor Murphy's legislation earlier this year for having, quote unquote, permanent emergency powers. That's an oxymoron. It's ridiculous that that exists. You know, nothing permanent is an emergency, it's an ongoing condition. So that's really a funny part point for me. But for the unemployment benefit, I mean, the idea is also, I mean, it is better for the economy and society as a whole that people can bridge those gaps on a short term and not have economic shocks to the system either. And that's why too much dramatic change at once in the economy typically leads to problems, at least short term. Thing is, how much of a short term pain can we deal with at one time before it settles down and goes normal again? That's always a concern on the economic side. So, yeah, we have to have a measured plan and a phased in plan, like I also mentioned before about the pensions becoming more privatized. I mean, that's the kind of stuff we need to have happen. So, if we do that, I think people will be as okay as this imperfect world can assure in terms of helping them to have a somewhat smooth economic life in their family and continue to contribute to the greater good.
Definitely. And as far as New Jersey goes, one of my favorite things about living in New Jersey, and something that I've learned to appreciate even more when I've spent time living outside of New Jersey, because it's not something that you just find everywhere, especially in America, is New Jersey's mass transit system and just having another option other than driving to get places. Now, I know it's still limited in where you could go, but when it comes to just even getting to and from work in and out of the city, or even just even, you know, throughout the county with buses and such, know, it's always good to have more options. And, you know, congested place like there, you know, you need it. And also driving really isn't for everybody either. Anyone who's driven on some of these highways in New Jersey probably has said a lot of cuss words at other drivers and such. So you mentioned New Jersey's mass transit infrastructure is broken and unnecessarily expensive, and you'll return accountability and responsibility to it and ensure people's money is appropriately used for its funding.
Yeah, there is a lot of financing that is coming from sources it's not supposed to in all the coffers in order to finance things like that. So yeah, we have to make it a more competitive process in terms of repairs, upgrades, things like that for the transit system as well, I mean, parking trains and buses and everything else. So yeah, I mean, it is true. I mean, I agree, we have a great state. I mean, I use public transit often, especially, you know, when I used to work in New York, I use it every day, of course, for that. So, you know, it's really important to have that infrastructure in place and working well. We've had problems with it. And like I said, the funding tends to come from different areas where the public had an idea that they were paying some part of their taxes for this project, and instead it went to this project. Mm-hmm. And you know, that accountability is lacking. And that's what we need also. We need a firm accountability of, okay, this is what we're paying for this improvement or whatever it is. And it's just kind of all over the map. And you know, money is, you know, slid back and forth between different funds. Again, no accountability. And the problem is that overall, you might have a very wastefully high revenue stream from the tax collection perspective. It's harder to account for, okay, where can we cut if the money is just being slid around all over the place? It's hard to track, like, which areas are getting the right level of funding versus too much versus too little. So if we could have more strict separation of that, then maybe we could have a better way to look at the budget overall and figure out where the waste is.
Well, and you mentioned you're in Manville, Boundbrook, that area?
I'm in Bridgewater, actually, but yeah.
Okay, so Raritan Valley line you're on.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in Roselle Park, so my town is on that line as well. Mm-hmm. And I know a big thing with the Raritan Valley line is a one-seat ride to New York, because for the longest time, you had to switch in Newark. And mm-hmm. I know a lot of it is because it's a diesel line. Diesel can't go under the tunnel. Right. But now they do have hybrid engines where it could be both diesel and electric. I've noticed those the past couple years when I was still commuting in and out of the city, you know, even just from where I live now in Bergen County. Mm-hmm. Now, what's your take on that? I mean, do you think that the ARC tunnel should have went through, because I know how many trains could go in to the tunnel at a time, and to New York Penn is another thing regarding, like, whether how much of a one seat ride the Raritan Valley line could be, for example.
Well, I mean, I hear a lot about that Gateway project. Yeah, I think you know, that seems like a very helpful project. Again, we have to make sure there's competitive bidding if we go forward with that project. So, I mean, part of it is, yeah, there should be the contracting out for that. But also, I mean, that should be reflected in the fees for the ridership, to the extent that if the people using it really want that project, that's the price of it. And you know, in that respect, I mean, we usually like a lot more of sort of a use tax, for example, which is that's a variety of what that is. And as opposed to just the general income tax across the board, you know, we're paying for things that have nothing to do with us individually. So in that respect, I mean, it kind of goes back actually also to Mr. Orman's proposal from 4 years ago, in the sense of, you know, what would you want to pay for? Well, it's going to be things that help benefit you, right? So if everybody does that, the appropriate amount of budget will be there for each different project. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Definitely. And yeah, and speaking of Mr. Roorman and New Jersey Transit, yeah, the one time I ran into him in person happened to be on the train.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it was like a couple months after the election, but I recognized him. So I sat next to him, called him for a few minutes before I got off my stop in Lyndhurst.
Okay.
But yeah, it's like only in New Jersey or the New York City metro area are you going to run into the Libertarian Party leader riding public transportation. But just shows, how just what it's like around here and congested and then in the necessity for certain things.
Look, I mean that's why I feel we tend to have candidates that know better what needs to happen. We've got people living in a bubble otherwise in the other two parties. They're not in touch with reality for the working class,
No.
for the middle class. And it's really, I mean, that's why they like to talk about sort of cookie cutter, one size fits all solutions for everything. And centralizing is really what holds us back. I mean, if more responsibility could be pushed down to the local level in terms of what works for that community versus the other community, that's where we're going to have a more efficient system, actually. And it's going to be the greatest benefit. And again, sort of in line with that sort of free market, invisible hands, makes the best result. More local, the better for that. I think it should be, a community deciding what's best for them. So, if that's the case, I mean, then I think, like I said, we're going to have a lot of improvements that we just can't have right now.
Wow. And you did visit all 21 counties during your campaign.
Two times. Yep.
Two times. Wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I'm
Yeah.
curious how that went. Like, did you just see and experience a lot that reinforced your beliefs and what you campaign on even more? Or were there some things that made you think about things a little more? I mean, how did it go?
Yeah, I mean, well, so I mean, the first, and just to by way of background for timing, I mean, the first time was during the petition phase, also it was like April into May tour. And then the other one was mostly end of July, August. And it was meet the candidate, ask your questions kind of thing. Besides that, I mean, overall, I had about 100 stops on this campaign, which is a lot for a third party
Oh,
typically.
yeah.
So, yeah, it was a very active year. I'm still going out all the time now, right up to the end. But
Nice.
I would say, as far as the tours themselves, I mean, there are areas, even though I'm a lifelong resident of the state, I mean, there are areas I hadn't been to, and so many different ways of life within New Jersey. It really
Oh,
is
yeah.
a mixture that's very rare otherwise. So it was really enlightening and educational for me to find out all the different things that different areas of the state are facing, all the crises that are going on that are holding back areas from developing and improving for everyone. I got a lot of ideas on that tour from the people. I mean, I was asking them, what's your concerns here in your area? And I got a great amount of feedback that did certainly help to, formulate and refine, the ideas in general. I mean, we're still the party of principle. We still have our basic platform of ideas, but we, I got to the chance to find out really, okay, how does that apply to this area or that area? And I mean, I feel I became a much better candidate and hopeful governor by learning all those things in all those different areas. I don't think the other guys went to every corner of the state like that this
Oh, I
year.
highly doubt it.
Yeah, and my goal was, I wanted to be able to say, I cared about every person in this state, and I wanted to go to every area I could to find out what's going to make things better for everybody. And I mean, a good leader, in my opinion, I mean, you listen to counsel from whoever is going to give you either advice or suggestions or ask questions that might lead you to think of better solutions. And in the end, you need to be able to make the call. Yeah, that's leadership in my mind. So, I mean, in my career, I've never been afraid of making that call once all the data is in, or at least, reasonable amount. I mean, on the one hand, you can't procrastinate forever because you only have 99% of the information. You can't necessarily always wait for the 100% to get something going and see how it is. And sometimes you can do something in a controlled environment, maybe a smaller environment, as a test bed and find out how it works once you have at least a good basis of, a fair amount of the information you need to make the call that this is worth a try. And so, in that respect, like I said, I mean, I learned so many things from the people in this state with my tours. It was very gratifying. And like I said, it made me a much better leader in whatever I do. So I think it was well worth it. I also did a slew of Board of Ed meetings, speaking on behalf of Parents for Choice, basically, and again, all the different choices, including the remote learning, not just the COVID-related stuff, and many other events outside of the specific tour stops for those two tours, local events, things like that. Just got to talk to the people, and that's nice. Where I'm most comfortable. Yeah. I really feel good when I'm, you know, talking face to face with people and able to discuss, you know, what their needs are, what their concerns are, what we can offer as solutions that we think will help. You know, those dialogues always wind up with people, you know, interested in joining our cause, at least, and voting for our party.
All right. And is there anything you'd like to plug before we go?
Well, I mean, I guess for an overview of the main platform planks, there is our website, www.meleforgovernor.com. And it's M-E-L-E and then the word F-O-R. There's all the information about the campaign. Also, I mean, for the party in general, you do have www.njlp.org. You can find out more about the party as a whole and what we're doing as a party to try to get involved with communities and help people. You know, that's really what it's about, is trying to make things better for everybody. And in that respect, to the extent I mentioned earlier briefly that the other parties seem to have, you know, widening, more extreme views, you know, separate from each other, I think we all have something to help everybody to have a better life. And, you know, that's really what it's about, is, you know, we want to make it a great place to be, a great life to experience, to be here in New Jersey. It's, you know, historically, it was always a great place. You know, it's deteriorated in recent times, and we want to get back to where we were.
All right. Excellent. Well, Greg Mealy, thank you again for being on, and good luck.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Thanks so much for the invitation. I'm glad to have the chance to chat with you and our audience.
All right. Definitely. Well, there you have it. In addition to incumbent Democrat Phil Murphy and Republican candidate Jack Cittarelli, yeah, there are other options running for governor in New Jersey, and you just got to hear one of them. There's also Madeline Hoffman with the Green Party running. I interviewed her last year on this program when she ran for U.S. Senator, so feel free to check out that episode. It's still up. And then there's Joanne Kunianski with the Socialist Workers Party, who I intend on interviewing later this week. So I look forward to interviewing more candidates in the future as well. I know that it's been, up until this episode, Green Party candidates that I interviewed in prior elections and this election as well. But this show isn't about just one party or one type of viewpoint. And it's not just about me. I mean, I'll throw in my two cents here and there, I know. But it's mainly about giving people a voice, letting people get their voices heard, getting their message out, and allowing people to be more aware of their options and to get to know their options better. That's really what this is about. And as long as you're going to have a government, get something out of it, one way or another. So it's been a great episode, great times. To hear more episodes, check out the podcast Get Yours Today. We're on Anchor, we're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, all over the place. Feel free to visit the Facebook page, Get Yours Today. Feel free to like, feel free to follow. Visit Get Yours Today at Anchor. Feel free to support through there. All is appreciated. And in the meantime, peace out.